Okay, I am going to go come back to the HITC systems, and I am going to tell you things which are part are extremely old and part are rather new. I think the reason I have to speak of old stuff is that the emergence of new techniques like STM forces us to recall that there are other techniques which have said a certain number of things and which have become a little bit forgotten with time or not noticed because they were not not said in the context which is the present one. So I think one has to remind some simple fact that we can get from different techniques, and so for that I have to recall very old stuff but modernized, of course. And the I'll show one of the things we have been working for years has been to work on disorder in HITC, essentially putting impurities, but we have been with Florence Rulli-Albinck working very much about using electron irradiation to create defects and to modify and to disorder clean systems in order to see the influence of the disorder, and that will be a part of the talk, a very important part of the talk, which is very recent. So the people involved in the work are essentially Julien Bogrov, who does an MR with me, who has done his PhD with me, but who is now quite grown and doing a very nice job. Florence Rulli-Albinck is doing nice transport measurement in single crystals of cuprates and using irradiation to modify them. And we get samples for the NMR. We need special samples, powders oriented, which can be oriented in a field, etc. While here, for the transport, we use single crystals, and those are done by these people. So, what I would like to tell you about is a number of things. First, to recall the problem of the phase diagram, which everybody knows, and begin to discuss at this stage the problem of native disorder, if there is in some of the families of cuprates. I'll show that NMR is a good probe of the disorder. I'll show how we can compare different families, and I'll show that IPCO 6.6 and IPCO 7 are very homogeneous cases, in which can be considered as really generic of the HITC systems. And then I'll try to look how disorder modifies the different lines of the phase diagram, and that's very important because when you are looking at a given system, you have to know which lines are sensitive to disorder and which are not. And finally, this is the longest part of the talk. I'll speak of Nernst experiment because we have been very much interested in learning about phase fluctuations and how disorder can affect phase fluctuations. And for this, we have done experiments paralleling those of Ong in Princeton, but in a situation where we have put in intentionally disorder in the system to try to understand the influence of disorder. And I'll have some conclusions and some speculations. So this is what everybody considers a generic phase diagram of cuprates. There are number of lines, an antiferromagnetic line, a superconducting dome, a pseudo-gap line, eventually spin glass or disordered magnetic regime, and nearly everybody would tell today that this is a generic phase diagram. I think my point is that this is true for the shape. The shape of the phase diagram is okay, and is certainly generic, whatever the system you take. But if you begin to put the numbers, the optimal TC is not generic. It's changing from system to system. And the whole concentration is something which is not well determined. It's really ad hoc procedures which are used to fix the optimum at 0.16 and to fix the points where TC disappears at 0.25 and 0.05 or 0.06. But this is purely ad hoc, and one very difficult parameter in these systems is the number of holes, which is very hard to determine, and you will see that this can have influences on the experiment. So first, why do I have to consider that disorder is important in this system? Well, very simply, if you take the different families of cuprates, if you take the best single crystals, the best resistivity curves have been published at the optimum in a range where the resistivity is linear in temperature, you immediately find out that these are not the same. The resistivities are not the same, and the main thing which changes is not the slope, it's the residual resistivity. So that means that for any solid-state physicist, you know that a residual resistivity means a disorder. So you have scatterers in some of the systems, and these scatterers probably play a role, and I can show you that they play a role because you find a very nice correlation between the residual resistivity and the optimum TC.
So the main negative residual resistivity also is coming from disorder, like in the case of YBCR.
What do you mean? Sorry?
Here, your residual resistivity is negative.
Yeah, if you take IPCO, it's one of the systems which have really nearly negative residual resistivity, if you extrapolate, which means that probably if you were able to suppress completely superconductivity, the residual resistivity, you will be nonlinear at the end somewhere.
It cannot be directly related to strength of disorder because it doesn't make sense. I mean,
of course, but it tells you that it's the best ordered. This is, and in fact, I have plotted here the data, which is the ratio of the residual resistivity divided by the slope, because the slope, I assume that the slope is probably similar from system to system, and that the data can be, you have some uncertainty due to the shape of the sample and stuff like that. But in any case, if you plot this ratio, or you could plot the residual resistivity as well, versus the TC for this optimal signal sample, you find that really the low TC systems have the largest residual resistivity, and the high TC system has a nearly negative or nearly zero residual resistivity and obtained like that. So this is a very simple observation. I think I have been showing that for at least 10 years. And the data is old. Maybe I have added points because we have been finding new samples. So disorder is detrimental to superconductivity, and some uncontrolled disorder is present in at least these families, which are LASCO and BISCO 2201. Which are what I would call, I used to call the low TC cuprates. There is another indication which is strongly telling you that disorder can have some importance in some families. It is the metal insulator transition. In this well accepted phase diagram, there is a further line which has been shown nicely by Bobinger and Ando, which is a metal insulator transition, which is seen by upturns in the resistivity. At the beginning, you need to put a field to keep superconductivity. So this line has been seen mainly in the low TC system at the beginning. But after a while, working on different systems, this was the first experiments on LASCO, here, you can see that you have upturns of the resistivity already for LASCO at 0.15, which is the optimum TC for LASCO. And what has been shown in 2000, that if you take BISCO doped with lanthanum, then you find that this line is much different. And so it shows that this metal insulator transition is very much linked with disorder here again, and depends on the system.
This is still done in the field, right?
Yeah, always.
So
we need that.
We heard this morning that the field enhances certain correlations.
Yeah.
So can you comment on how much it?
Well, these positions of these lines, the fact that they are so different shows that something is different in the system. So there is no way out. And the big difference that we can find is also reflected by the residual resistivity of the single crystals, and in my opinion is disorder, because all this is somewhat linked to disorder. Any metal insulator transition in this system is linked to disorder. So my feeling here again is that the metal insulator transition is associated with intrinsic disorder, and that one has to be very careful.
Less
apparently.
About
the
higher
possibly. Possibly, I don't. I am not. I think I am talking on very generally. The kinds of disorder are going to be very different from system to system. So the way they affect superconductivity and the different parameters could be very different. If I use point defects, I'll get some kind of very strong disorder in the plane, which can scatter very much. If you could put the disorder outside, it can be different. I am not qualifying the disorder at this stage. I am just showing that some disorder is present in this system and makes the differences with the others. Of course, one strong argument has been the STM experiments, which have shown, and that you have heard Seamus Davis for years, showing you that you have patches, that there is big disorder on the surfaces of BSCO. So there are arguments showing that you have disorder in these systems. And in the initial stage in 2000 and 2002, this was interpreted as a distribution of oxygen content. I don't know whether this is still the, this is probably not exactly what would say Seamus Davis today, but in any case, the kind of interpretation that you can have is that the distribution of the gaps that are seen in STM can be due to a distribution of oxygen content, to a local distribution of oxygen content at the level of these patches which are seen. So if we are interested in doing physics on this system, we want really to understand very well this phase diagram, and there are questions which are very important about the phase diagram, which remain not really answered. What is the origin of the pseudo gap? Is that a phase transition? Is that a competing order? Is there a crossover or phase transition? Is there a new order parameter here? Are we dealing with a situation where we have preformed pairs? That is, that this would be precursor to superconductivity. This is certainly one of the questions which still needs answer, and which is very the answers are very controversial nowadays. And the second is, do we have a transition to a Fermi liquid? Where is it located, etc.? And the third is, does the pseudo gap join TC, or do we have a quantum critical point? All these are questions which are raised for now 5 or 10 years, and which are not really answered. And I think it is very important to be sure that disorder doesn't affect the experimental, the experiments you are doing, to be able to answer these questions. So my feeling is that understanding the disorder is quite essential to be able to answer these questions. So now I'll switch to the technique I am very familiar with, which is NMR. And I want to show you that NMR is a good probe of this order. I'll try to explain that in detail. What one usually plots in NMR or reports, and most of the papers we have been reporting for years, are just giving NMR shifts. Here I am just showing you the NMR shift of yttrium, because this is data that I have been taking in the group, which is giving you this local susceptibility versus temperature. And in most papers of NMR people, you just report these kind of things, shifts, T1s. They give information on the average susceptibility. So essentially, the shift contains a chemical part, which is due to the bonding, to the orbital effects, and a part which is linked to the spin susceptibility through a hyperfine coupling. This is one of the earliest determination of the pseudo gap. In fact, in IPCO, it's by this anomalous behavior of the susceptibility which decreases nearly to zero just when you reach TC. Is something which was absolutely unexpected, and one can pin the maximum of the susceptibility as the opening of the pseudo gap, and that's this line in the phase diagram. But
in that phase diagram, are the two phases supposed to be touching?
No, this is because X is not the the whole doping. This is a big problem, as I said. Hole doping is very hard to determine. X is measuring the oxygen content, and it happens that the oxygen content, the hole doping is not linear in the oxygen content in this system. I can explain easily why, because you are putting some oxygen which converts the chain copper into copper 2+. So you have a plateau, for instance, here, which corresponds to 6.6, and here you have a phase transition from tetragonal to orthorhombic.
Even if we don't know the relation between oxygen and the true concentration, if there is a glass, we should see.
There is a glassy phase here, and the problem is that you jump in hole doping when you go from here to here very abruptly. So this range of oxygen doping in IPCO is extremely dangerous, because it depends on the order of the oxygen in the chains, and so two samples with the same content are not the same. So you have to be very careful in IPCO for that. But here and here, as I'll show, these are very good situations where the whole content is well defined and the system is rather ordered.
Is there a distribution of shifts, or is there a new?
Okay, here, I am coming to that. So all this is the curve, this is exactly the same curve. If I take the TC versus hole doping curve by using the colors, you have the correspondence with the dome. And in IPCO, you know that we cannot go to the overdoped regime. And the thing which we are seeing is an NMR signal. This is, for instance, the yttrium NMR signal for 0.6, and this is the NMR signal for 0.7. And this signal has a width. So usually what we report here is just the average shift, or the maximum, as you want. And these are the points which are showing here. So you take many, many spectra, and you do that, and you will obtain all that. But in fact, you have more information here, because you have the width. And the width gives you an information, because the mean value is the mean value of this quantity, but this distribution is telling you the distribution of these quantities.
Is that real?
Yeah, this one.
There's one on the left, there's
a part could be noise.
Sorry, what? No, I'm talking about the shoulder on the right arm.
This one?
It's purple, and then it's
okay. This can be real.
Where is it from?
Because you have a slight distribution of oxygen content. I'll come to that. So, now, these experiments are done on bulk sample. And what I call bulk sample is 0.1 to 0.5 grams. So the line that you see represents what's happening in a sample of this size. It's not the 100 angstrom over 100 angstrom flat square. It's 0.5 gram of the sample, which means a number of some millions times larger.
How is it when you do the experiment, you grind up the...
Yeah, you have to work on a powder, and usually we orient the powder in the field. That is, we have powders which are formed of small single crystals, and you apply a field which orients the particles because of the anisotropy of the susceptibility.
Just to, sorry, I understand. So it's basically a powder in glue.
And we hold that in glue.
And how big are the particles in the powder? And you say the formula, but
10 micron.
10 micron on the side. The little 10 micron cubes of platelets, you know the morphology.
It's the rather platelets.
Yeah. And then the microwaves basically come there's an orientation. The microwaves relative to the...
Yeah. It depends whether we apply the field. We can do any orientation. It's not microwave. It's radio frequencies, and that enters in the whole sample. No problem. So, what are the contributions to the spectral shape? You have some which are just due to spin-spin interactions, but you have also inhomogeneities of doping. So, on such a large sample. Chemically, when you try to put oxygen, you know that when you try to enter oxygen in a single crystal, it's not that easy. You have to stay a long time to reach very homogeneous oxygen content. So if you have any inhomogeneity in your grains or in your bulk sample, you are going to get a distribution. This is not the kind of distribution that Seamus Davis is speaking about. Huh? Now you can have microscopic distribution of the elders, which is due to defects. So if you have defects in your sample, they are scattering, you get RKKY oscillations, and the charge oscillations are giving you oscillation of the local density of state, and that's exactly the kind of things we are seeing. Furthermore, if as we are sensitive to spin effect, if you have defects which give magnetic type of scattering, I would say a magnetic modulation of the magnetic response, this is the case in any correlated electron system. When you have a defect, it can induce an oscillation of the spin polarization around it, and that gives you also oscillations. So all these contribute to the broadening. Unlike the situation of STM, where only this one is seen, these two would be seen, of course. But as STM is only seeing a small surface, all is due to a local type of distribution. So the thing we did from the beginning, at the time we were interested in one-layer materials, there was a big problem with the lanthanum strontium, which remains because lanthanum strontium is very original, but there was no one-layer material with high TC for a while until the mercury compound was discovered. And when the mercury 2201 was discovered, we immediately did NMR on this, and of course in that case you don't have yttrium, so we used planar oxygen NMR. And the thing which we noticed at that time when doing that is that first it's a high TC compound, it has the pseudo gap, it can be underdoped, optimally doped, it has all the features that you find in IPCO. The thing which was interesting is we tried to correlate the line width of the oxygen 17 in the different one-layer systems. And we found that in the published data, the thallium 2201, the mercury 2201, were those which had the smallest line width, while lanthanum strontium and bisco 2201 had large line width. And this, if you refer the line width to the shift, gives you a kind of percentage of the distribution of the susceptibility. It can be about 20% in the thallium. In our samples of mercury, it was 50, and it was probably not the best homogeneity we could have realized. And we find that lanthanum strontium and Bisco-2201 had large line width. So we were led to conclude at that time already, and this is PRL 1997, that in the one-layer compounds, some were somewhat dirty and had a large distribution of the local responses as compared to the thallium and mercury. So at that time already, we were saying, be careful, the LOTC compounds are not that clean. There is disorder. It's in this paper. It was the first paper of the PhD of Julien Bobrov. And in fact, when we compare to IPCO 7, the same number would give us 20%. So IPCO is as good as thallium, I would say, for that. After the Siemens-Davis story, we have been trying to go further and to analyze as much as we can the histogram of the local contributions. Remember that the actual situation is that you have a shift which depends of position on your sample, which contains all the three parameters I have mentioned depend of the position, but the chemistry is not so strongly affected, so sigma, this parameter is not much affected, but the hyperfine coupling can be affected by the local arrangement of the atoms if there is any disturbance. And the susceptibility can, of course, if you have a distribution of whole content, the chi will depend of the whole content. So what we have done to try to analyze these experiments, in which we find that the curves change shape when you go to lower temperature, and you have a tail which tells you that you have somewhere a distribution that you can try to analyze. So what we have done is merely assume that these quantities are not much dependent of disorder and put all the line width we assign it to the distribution of whole content. So we are doing the most pessimistic analysis in which we assign all the width of the lines to a distribution of whole content. So how can we do that? It's very easy. I just turn the curve, and these are calibration curves which give you the susceptibility versus temperature for the different whole contents. And I am just taking the spectra and saying that you can analyze as having the each frequency correspond to the contribution of lower oxygen content, of a different oxygen content, and that gives you the shape that you observe. The first thing that you can see in any case is that in such as IPCO 7 and IPCO 6-6, you have the noise level. So you have no signal in the 07 which comes from the 06.6, or no signal in the 06.6 which comes from the 07. This is already very, very different from what Siemens reports, because what Siemens reports is that when you take an underdoped system, it contains optimally doped fractions, and when you look at an optimally doped sample, you find black spots which correspond to the underdoped. So already this simple observation tells you that you don't have a large contribution of one phase on the other. But we could do much more. We could fit all the spectra at all temperatures using a distribution of oxygen content, and this allows us to tie up the, you don't see maybe the fits here, but we can fit, there are blue points which correspond to a fit here also, there are blue points correspond to the fit. So with this distribution of oxygen content, we can fit completely the spectra at all temperatures, And we, if we change a little bit the distribution, that's what would be the spectrum. So that tells you that we have a reliable determination of the distribution of oxygen content using just an analysis of this. And we can transform, of course, the distribution of oxygen content using the TC curve as a distribution of whole content if we use the parabolic law to assign whole content to a given TC.
If your samples are not properly annealed, then the distribution functions go nuts.
If they were even better, probably our distribution would be narrower. So this is really a pessimistic determination of the distribution of whole content in this.
If you have better samples of distribution narrow
down. If you had smaller samples, they would be probably more homogeneous, or if the heat treatments were extremely long. We did that just to show that the situation was different. We didn't try to get the best sample in the world to do that.
Put any of this Fredel oscillation physics into this analysis either. I mean, in fact, of course, a single impurity can produce this.
Yeah, that we have done hundreds of experiments on that. We have at least 10 papers.
And this in the Y123.
Yeah, of course.
But then doesn't that also contribute to that width?
Of course. That would contribute as well. Exactly. So what I am saying is this is the maximum,
the worst case
which we can
possibly.
All of it, absolutely, exactly.
Not any physics.
Exactly. That was the importance here. So the maximum distribution of whole content. And I compare that to what is given in Shimus data. So if I compare to bismuth 2212, it's the black. This is the width that he has. And if I compare to Lascaux, bismuth 2212 is the black, and Lascaux is the red. And as I say, this is the most unfavorable situation.
Is 07 supposedly stoichiometric?
What?
07 sample.
Well, the reason, let us be clear, the reason we are using 07 and 06.6, it's because it's the situations in which you have well-ordered chains, and so the chains being well-ordered, you have less defects, while if you would try to do that in this regime, it would be more difficult. You could have more distributions. So we have taken the plateau and the two plateaus, in fact, because here also there is a plateau of TC. Because these correspond to well-ordered chains where all the oxygen are filled for IPCO7, and for IPCO66, it's chemically the fact that you have one chain over two, and the extra oxygen are just at random on the other chains, which we know that an oxygen just transforms a copper, the two nearby copper from 1+ to 2+, so it's not a dopant. So in all this range here of oxygen content, you don't change the doping. So this is the reason for this plateau. Okay, yeah?
First. You looked at the two-chain 248.
I didn't, but it was published, and I checked that the numbers are even smaller than for IPCO66. The width is even smaller.
An argument that's going to say to people, we do have some systems
which
are highly ordered.
Of course, this is what we have said in this paper in 2002. This is published. I mean, it's an old stuff. So the argument that we have is that IPCO is homogeneous and has no charge segregation.
But it seems that this distribution of 07 is extremely artificial. I mean, it's extremely asymmetric, right?
The reason is natural, because it's somewhat hard to enter perfectly oxygen, to fill completely the oxygen chains. Maybe we would have needed to do a sample annealing it for a month, etc., to reach the best sample.
Yeah,
which we didn't do because the answer was already significant for what we wanted. Yeah.
Oh yeah, a quick technical question. Is there any significant difference among these materials in terms of your ability to orient the powders?
No.
No. So they're all sort of equally well oriented.
Yeah. No, no, they are correct. No, no, they are correct. Yeah, at these two concentrations, even if O6 is okay, we can orient it. So let's go to the influence of disorder now. And so, were we so interested in that? It's because we wanted to put impurities in high TC materials to study the impurities. So we had to start with clean materials. So we have been working essentially on IPCO 7 and IPCO 6.6 because we knew they were clean enough. So by putting, we could see effects with small amount of impurities. I am not going to speak of that. This I spoke of that so many times. I just want to begin to discuss the questions I was mentioning about the phase diagram and trying to see what disorder does to these. So these are the two questions I have been asking before concerning the pseudo gap and the way it finishes here. And I am going to try to see what happens if we put defects. And I am going to use an experiment I did in 1991, so it's old, which was to put a lot of zinc, because we knew zinc was killing superconductivity, and just retrace the phase diagram with 4% zinc. And I'm going to call this a new high TC cuprate, which is called IPCOS, in which I change X. And this is the phase diagram of this system. This is the pure, and this is IPCOS. And IPCOS, as you can see, has first no big change in TN, because in fact zinc does a dilution effect which reduces the number of bonds, so it reduces a little bit TN. In this range, the change is large. There is a larger disordered range, and there is a large depression of TC. Superconductivity dome has been reduced. Notice that at this plateau composition, TC has gone to zero. So you can kill completely superconductivity with 4% zinc in this system.
TC suppression doesn't correlate with the bare value of TC.
With what?
With the original value of TC. I mean, TC varies by very little.
Less here than here. It's very important. It's very important.
Excuse me, Andy. There is the behavior of the magnetism. I mean, that's not the main topic of your talk, but nevertheless, this is somewhat different from LSCO, where within zinc you actually enhance the region of the phase diagram where you have long-range magnetism.
Is that true?
Do you have it?
Is that true?
Yeah. Experiments have been done in the various groups, and there are some below, but there are others too. Their interpretation is probably that zinc pins the holes, and since the holes.
It's possible. I think this is not the case here.
See this, because this is really reverse to.
This is a. This in this system we find out, and we have arguments that zinc doesn't change the hole doping on all the phase diagrams.
Yeah, but I mean, the argument LSCO,
the zinc pins hole, yeah. If this is the case, it completely changes the response. Okay. So
the change or the
planes. This is good on only in the planes. The zinc is no problem. So if you take this here, you measure the shift of the yttrium again versus temperature, and this is what you find. And you find that is absolutely independent of zinc doping. That is, you can go to 4% and you can. So this is a 91 paper in which I showed that the pseudo gap, which is seen here, is absolutely independent of zinc content. That is, this line is absolutely insensitive to disorder. So this is very important because it tells you that this line being very robust, when it's measured experimentally, whatever the system, it has significance. while this one is not so robust, it can be affected by disorder, for instance.
So this, I guess this T-star line sometimes is defined as where interval length is best, correlation length of, let's say, a couple of lattice spacings or something like this?
I define it as the temperature at which the susceptibility begins to drop, or we can define it as by putting a mathematical shape for this function in the course, which defines a gap, and this would be the energy of this gap. It would be the same.
That's right. But what I'm saying is that, I mean, if the central magnetism is so short correlated and zinc so far apart, then clearly we should be.
This has nothing to do with zinc. It's really a quantity which is true in the pure system. The only thing you do is when you put zinc, you are killing superconductivity, and you check that by killing superconductivity, you don't kill the pseudo gap.
Yeah, but I mean, pseudo gap is a much higher assumption than superconductivity. So
yeah.
What I'm asking is how you rationalize that T star doesn't change. I mean, there is no superconductivity there.
It's true. How do I rationalize? It is insensitive to disorder. This is the experiment which tells you that. I can tell you more. If it is due to, if it is of magnetism or magnetic origin and linked to J and the number of holes, it's reasonable.
So does the Swiss cheese model still work? I guess locally destroy the coherence.
I have to mention that what we are measuring here is the yttrium far from the impurities. So we are trying to see the mean field effect on the system associated with the impurities.
Right.
So near the impurities, very strange thing happens. The system becomes paramagnetic. You have Curie terms which develop, etc. But far from the impurities, you have no change in the pseudo gap.
Yeah, but the TC suppression, can I think of it as reducing the...
Oh, but here TC is at zero.
Yes, I think each zinc goes in and reduces superfluid.
I am not sure that the switches model applies, but okay, we can say that.
Yeah. But something happens to the distribution. In other words, when you throw in the zinc,
yeah, of course. Of course, all the shape is completely different.
Like how wide is presumably the distribution gets much wider.
Of course.
The question is how wide does it get on the scale of the nice of the ship?
It's large. It's beginning
so
to
the
be.
The biggest
large.
Effect is simply on the width of the. You have a huge effect on the distribution.
Mm-hmm.
So.
No, but it's not the distribution of hole doping.
No, the distribution of yttrium shifts.
Yeah.
And so there's a large effect of the impurities on various local densities.
Of course, but near the impurities.
Those effects are much larger.
No,
the width of that distribution, the difference between different sites is much larger than any temperature-induced change.
Yeah, but in fact, in this situation, you resolve the different sites. You have a central line which corresponds to sites which are far from the impurities, and this is the one which gives you that.
They're close. Oh, that breaks. So there are other sites where something else happens.
Yeah, completely.
So this is just far from. So is this?
Yeah. This is what I'm saying. This is far from the impurities themselves.
Are you shocked by them?
No.
And if you're close, something happens.
Of course. No, I am not shocked. There is no reason to be shocked. To be shocked at all. It's natural. I could have spent one or 2 hours explaining you what happens near the impurity.
But the point is, you're trying to tell us a story about superconductivity.
No,
what happens near the impurities may be important.
I am not telling anything about superconductivity. I am telling something on pseudo gap up to now.
Yeah, but then there are sites where the pseudo gap goes away too. Exactly. Right? So if I look at the shifts, if I look at the out in those distributions, you tell me about the means. Are there particular atoms where you don't see the pseudo gap anymore? So in other words,
at very short distances. Yeah. But of course, don't take the situation where TC is zero. If I take a situation where TC has been reduced by a factor of two, then the pseudo gap is still the same for most of the sample. Yeah. There is no problem.
But the point is, from this, you can then extract the characteristic length scale to do with the formation of the pseudogap. In other words, this is...
No, no, what I just want to say is that you, if you put disorder, you don't kill the average behavior a long distance. The scattering is not kill, is not modifying the...
But the question is, now what's the length scale?
Yeah, it's two or three lattice spacing. Let's go now to the to IPCO 7 and do the same stuff with IPCO 7. IPCO 7, the zero of the shift is here, and here is the susceptibility. It has a very weak temperature dependence. And it's very hard from there to define a pseudogap. One could pick this maximum as being a pseudogap, but you see that when you put zinc, in that case, the nothing changes. And you don't see whether there is a maximum or anything else. So here, defining a pseudogap is going to be extremely difficult. And nobody has ever seen, when you suppress superconductivity with impurities, anything developing and telling you that the shift would reduce to zero, as it is the case at for the underdog. So the lesson is here: if a pseudogap exists, it's not so, it cannot be well above TC. It's really it can stick at TC, or it's even below. So this is one of the arguments which have been used for quantum critical point, but I think we have no proof whatsoever that a pseudogap occurs below TC. So this curve, which is very often claimed essentially by Talon, Loram, and others as being the continuation of the pseudogap line, I think there is no experimental argument for that at present. The only argument which exists is if you put impurities, you don't see a gap opening there. So the situation is that when you put impurities, this line doesn't change. So by continuation, you could think that it's the same and that you can prolong it. This is what Talon and Loram have been doing. They have just been telling you that this line, its continuation is here. But that is already an interpretation, because if the pseudogap merges with the gap, with the superconducting gap, the only thing that experiments tell you is that here the superconducting gap is affected by the disorder, and so you lose it when you kill superconductivity.
If you would be willing to accept that at the optimally doped system there is still a weak signature, so to speak, for a pseudogap in the night shift, would you then say that the dependence on this order comparing the 6 and the 7 would be both alike, or would you say that there's a weak
different
shift
of the night shift? For me, there is a big difference here and here, because here, if there is a pseudogap which remains here, it is affected by superconductivity.
It's because the magnetic correlation is small.
No, it becomes smaller. Here, the magnetic correlation length becomes smaller.
Would you just put back the 7? Just the
7
down?
You see? Maybe there is a small shift of this maximum, but it doesn't mean for me that it is a pseudogap. Really, there is a small shift, there is a maximum, and I think I'll have argument after what I'll say within the coming half an hour. I'll have arguments to explain what's happening here.
So you wouldn't say that has anything to do with change of magnetic correlation between the 7 and the 6?
It could. Of course it could. We have a reduction of the correlation length when we go to the higher concentration, to the highly doped.
If I'm just very naive, imagine I constructed a length scale, which Gil was talking about, which is roughly speaking V Fermi over T star, which is right, the pseudogap length scale. Now, as pseudogap marches down the doping, this length scale becomes bigger and bigger, and at some point it becomes comparable to the distance between zincs.
Mm-hmm.
Right? At that point, something I would expect to change. At this point, I expect the silica gap to begin being affected by the impurities. Is that, roughly speaking, where you see the change or not?
I have to put the numbers to realize it could be there.
Okay.
It could be there. It could be. It could be a possibility, but it could be merely that you are in a superconductor which is more traditional, and that you don't know how to distinguish the superconducting gap and the pseudo gap. If they are confounded, then if TC suppresses the gap, if defects suppress the gap, they suppress the gap. So the fact that you don't see a gap here when you put disorder is not proving you that there is a pseudo gap independent of the superconducting gap. It's a little bit tricky to be able to answer these kind of questions, and that's why they are not answered at this stage.
Okay.
Another point which is interesting that you can see from this data is that if you take this phase diagram for IPCO, which I call of IPCOs, you find that, as he remarked, TC is much more affected in the underdoped regime than in the optimal regime by the disorder. And in fact, you have a point where you have lost superconductivity, which is at much higher doping than in the pure system. So it means that if you put disorder in a cuprate, the dome is going to be deformed. So I think it is extremely dangerous to use a law to rationalize the different high TC systems by mapping their domes. This is done every day. And in fact, the dome which is used as a reference is lanthanum strontium. And as lanthanum strontium has a 40 KTC, it's not clear that this is a reference. So in my opinion, the fact that we don't have a very good parameter to measure the concentration of holes is really a problem. We have really no good parameter. The only way people have found up to now is just to map the domes and using 0.16 at the maximum and putting these concentrations. So it might work in some cases. Maybe it's okay when you are mapping systems which have TCs which are 90, 85, 100, etc. But when you are mapping a system which has a TC of 10K with a system which has an optimal TC of 10K with a system which has an optimal TC of 100K, this is certainly wrong. So let's come to Nernst. So I don't know where I am in time, but my colleague has been speaking so much that I can speak. So let's speak about Nernst. So Nernst experiments are well known now. Ong has done a lot of work on that. If you apply a gradient of temperature on a single crystal, you develop, in the presence of a field, you develop a transverse voltage, which is due to the fact that carriers are sensing the temperature gradient, and you have transport coefficient, which give you this Nernst term. In a normal metal, this is very small. And this can be shown by, I'm not going to do the demonstration, it's done in the papers. You write the situation in zero field, you write the situation in field, you expect that the currents in the two direction, longitudinal and transverse, are zero if you just have a gradient of temperature. And you immediately find that the voltage which appears here is a combination of two terms. One, this first one, is properly linked with the the real Nernst effect. The other is just a combination of the thermoelectric power and the Hall angle. And this quantity here is going to be the quantity which is of interest. So the Nernst coefficient is just the ratio of E divided by gradient of temperature B. It contains two terms, and this term is going to be the one which is of interest. The other is just thermal power and the whole content and the whole effect. In normal metals, these two terms nearly cancel, and the Nernst coefficient is zero, well, nearly zero. Now, in a superconductor, you have vortices in a type 2 superconductor, and these vortices, when you apply a field, are like this. And if you have a thermal gradient, you have a flow of entropy linked with this, with the vortices. So you have a flow of vortices which develops a huge Nernst coefficient. If you write the Josephson relation for the flow of vortices, you can get the value of the Nernst coefficient. And this is well known. It's a very good way to see the mobility of the vortices in classical superconductors. If you take the Nernst coefficient in indium, you find that it depends on the applied field, and you measure quite nicely the field for which you have the pinning of the vortices and mobility in the in mixed state. So this is something which has been exploited by Ong's group, who has done a lot of experiments in Antonov strontium, in which he has seen a Nernst effect. Nernst effect is easy. Here is Nernst coefficient versus applied field for different temperatures. And you see that at low temperatures, you have zero Nernst coefficient at very low temperature because the vortices are pinned. And then you have an onset of mobility over the vortices, which gives a huge signal. And when you climb temperature, the mobility becomes larger and larger. When you reach at 30 K, you don't have any onset. So you pass the critical line for the mobility of the vortices. And you see that when you go above TC, which is 27 K or 28 K in that case, you still have a large Nernst signal, which is maintained when you go up to 60 K and even more. So there is a large Nernst signal above TC detected in this system, and this has been shown, has been considered, there is no way for such a huge positive Hertz signal to associate it to anything else other than superconductivity. So it must be linked with superconductivity. Whether one can speak of vortices and their motion, or whether this is something due to the superconductive order parameter is still a question. It could be fluctuations, but still, this large signal is the signature of superconducting fluctuations, which pushes the idea that TC is a loss of long-range phase coherence, and that you have a large regime in which you have lost the coherence, but you still have preformed pairs and some fluctuations of the order parameter, which give you this Nernst signal. And this effect is pronounced, you see, when you look at this system. This is the TC curve versus strontium content, and this is the Nernst coefficient regime, which is this is the onset of the Nernst coefficient. This is really the beginning of any positive Nernst coefficient, and you see that you have a large regime which extends in the underdoped region to very high temperatures. And this has been raised as an implication on the physics of high TC, saying that the pseudo gap regime can be a regime of preformed pairs, and that this could be due to. And this has been a very strong argument for the preformed pair scenario of the pseudo gap in high TC. So what we have said, okay, rather than doing that on being minded as I am, I said, rather than doing that on low TC cuprates, let's do that on high TC cuprates. And so the idea was to take the two that I like much, IPCO 6.6 and IPCO 7. And the first thing we did was to measure in the unadopted IPCO 6.6. And you see the curves in IPCO 6.6 are very similar to those I have shown. You have zero non-signal, then the signal climbs when vortices are beginning to be mobile. You climb temperature, you reach TC, and you still find that you have a non-signal, but the point is it seems to be negative, and this is a little bit a problem. But above TC, you still have a non-signal. So the slope at the beginning is the one you have to consider, the effect at large fields. So usually what one uses is the initial slope of the non-signal. So it's positive and it becomes negative progressively. So if you plot the initial slope versus temperature, you find that it drops fast, and then there is the data is taken much higher temperature. There is a slow upturn and a strong negative term there. And this is somewhat difficult to understand, because if you want to know which is the onset of a positive non-signal, which is the one which could be due to superconductivity, you have to know what happens in the normal state. And this we have done a careful work, which is in the paper, which is not in this here, but the point is that the onset of this positive non-signal cannot be very high. We did the full analysis, measuring both the Hall effect and the thermoelectric power, measuring its temperature dependence and reducing it to get this term, and this is what we obtained. So you see that any non-coefficient which could be associated with superconductivity only starts at 80 K, which is about 25 K above TC of this system. But in any case, this is not a huge range of non-signal above TC. This is a pure system. So in the pure system, although it's very difficult to determine with great accuracy, we find a small range of non-signal. It's interesting to compare. I just show you the comparison with the BISCO 2212 given by Ong's group. And you see in the overdoped, this is the Meissner signal. This is the non-signal. We use the same scales. This is in IPCO 6.6, the Meissner signal, non-signal. And this is the underdoped BISCO 2212. So you see that this underdoped IPCO is more similar to the overdoped BISCO than to the underdoped BISCO. So it seems already that we can say by this simple comparison that the Nernst effect is not that large in IPCO 6.6, which is an underdoped case. But what interests us is to see what disorder produces. And we have done experiments for a few years now in which we have very carefully used the radiation to disturb, to put defects in cuprates. We use electron irradiation, which create point defects. They kick off some copper or some oxygen from the planes, so you have point defects which are created that way, and you see that the resistivity curve, for instance, of IPCO 7, you have a nice Matheson rules which applies. You can increase the residual resistivity quite a lot. You begin to reach the insulating regime, nearly, and you can reduce TC even down to TC equals 0. This is IPCO 7, this is IPCO 6.5. So this is a situation where we have shown that we create a very homogeneous disorder in the system, and we have a very good control of the damage down to TC equals 0. And we could, for instance, show that TC decreases and goes to 0 quasi-linearly, contrary to Abrikosov-Gorkov expectations, and that this could be explained by the fact that the system becomes so dirty that you enter in a bad meta regime, the best regime for the arguments developed by Emery and Kivelson about loss of phase coherence due to the disorder in this system. So we have said 2 years ago that this observation is indicating somewhere that when the system is highly damaged, when the resistivity is high, phase fluctuations play a role, and we begin to not only to get pair breaking, but also loss of phase coherence due to the quantum phase fluctuations. I'll try. I stop when you want. So we have been trying to do that by irradiating IPCO 7 samples. And you see, the thing that we can show, I take an IPCO 7 with TC equal 80K, so I have irradiated it. You see TC is here, and we have still an enhanced signal which remains above TC in that case. For instance, I compare 3 samples of IPCO with different TCs because they have been irradiated quite a lot. I show the enhanced signal here versus temperature. And you can see that the null signal decreases, decreases very sharply in the pure sample. It's nearly a few degrees. You have lost all the null coefficient. But if you irradiate the sample, decrease TC, you see that the null signal survives above the TC of the sample and seem to survive nearly to where was the TC of the pure sample, which means that the null signal really seems to persist not so far from the TC0 of the pure crystal. And we can do that again. So maybe I can pass that. Well, this basically shows that in our IPCO 7, our linear decrease of TC with irradiation is associated with some phase coherence, and indeed we find that there is an amp signal, which is the best indication that you have kept some superconductivity in your system and lost the phase coherence in this range of temperatures. So this is a rather good argument for explaining what we did, and so we wanted to see what was happening in IPCO 6.6. So we repeated this kind of experiment in IPCO 6.6 with electron irradiation. And you see here again, you can decrease TC to about 30K, and you keep an enhanced signal well above 30K. So here again, we can do the analysis. Here is the diamagnetic signal. Here is TC. Here is the enhanced signal. And this is the onset of the enhanced signal. So we have an onset which is about 75K. For a system for which TC equal about 30K. And we did that for various samples. I mean, it's interesting to compare, for instance, this data with a pure underdoped BISCO, which is the Y equal 0.5, which had 30K of TC. And look, here is diamagnetic signal, here's diamagnetic signal, here is NERD signal, same scales. So if you compare that face to face, these two systems are nearly the same. The only difference is that this is a system in which we have reduced TC by a factor of 2 by electron irradiation. This is a pure system. So for me, it's a very strong, this strong similarity seems to indicate that in these systems, the null signal is due to the fact that TC could have been higher but has been depressed by some disorder which is intrinsic.
Residual resistivity for these two materials?
I didn't do the comparison, but we could do. But so we did that. We even take a sample which has a TC of 5K, so we have nearly killed superconductivity in it. And you look at the nonce signal, you see that nonce is flat and starts to depart here. So here, if you plot the onset of the Nernst signal, it seems to be very little dependent on the TC of the sample. Of course, when you look at high value of the Nernst signal, then you have a depression when TC is smaller. So you have this curve drop faster, of course, but you keep a Nernst signal at high temperatures. So basically, in all these systems, the onset seems to be not so far from what was the TC of the pure system, and the range in which you have a Nernst signal extends when you have more and more disorder. The less disorder, the pure starting material has a smaller range. Okay.
Do you
run into
the pseudogap when you irradiate?
No. It's irradiation is like zinc. Okay. It's exactly the same effect. So the conclusion of this is that when you put defects, you decrease TC, but at the same time you have some loss of phase coherence, and this loss of phase coherence makes that you have an increased regime of superconducting fluctuation, which can extend to what could be the TC0 of the pure, to what was the TC0 of the pure sample. And so I think that the effect of disorder on the Nernst signal, which is stronger in the underdoped cases, is such that it leaves superconducting pairs survive in the normal state in the disordered crystals. So obviously, the Nernst signal doesn't extend to something like 75K for the underdoped IPCO 6-6. It extends to 98K for the IPCO 7. So the onset of the Nernst signal in the pure system is lower for the underdoped than the overdoped. So you cannot link that to a pseudo gap. So I think there is no link between the Nernst signal and the pseudo gap in the pure system. And what our results suggest is that the Nernst signal, which is seen in the pure compounds, is just associated to the disorder, which is intrinsic to these pure compounds, and just tells you what would be TC if the compound was cleaner. So I think it is important to realize that there is a fluctuation regime, and in most experiments, the fluctuation regime is something like that. That is, it's smaller in the underdoped, and it becomes larger with respect to TC in the is smaller in the overdoped, and it becomes larger with respect to TC in the underdoped. If the system is not so clean, this fluctuation regime stays the same, and the superconducting dome has shrunk. So you have a large superconducting regime. And the question which is still important in all the experiments which try to track the pseudo gap and to see what happens to the pseudo gap in this range, it's extremely clear that some techniques do not make the difference between the pseudo gap and the fluctuations. In principle, they even conclude that the pseudo gap is precursor to superconductivity. I think the reason is if you have a gap, you have reason if you have superconducting fluctuation to still keep a track of the superconducting gap. So you could still see eventually in STM a superconducting gap, the traces of a superconducting gap in these regions, and think that this is a pseudo gap. So there might be still a problem trying to understand which experiments are really telling you what is the behavior of this line. I think in the NMR experiment we show that it goes like that. I don't know whether it follows that or whether it goes straight below, but some experiments are just probably interpolating this and telling you that that the line goes that way. But I'm not sure they are right, because they are unable to make the difference between the two. Okay, I think I have said most of what I wanted to say. Sorry.
then what, in your opinion, is the pseudo gap regime? How would you characterize it? Or I want to come in.
I think precisely the pseudo gap is well defined when you can secure that it differs from the superconducting fluctuation regime.
Right.
And in this range, we have no difficulty because it's much higher in temperature than the fluctuation regime. When you reach this regime, you don't know. And the small maximum that we have in susceptibility could be linked with superconducting fluctuations. You have, if you measure the susceptibility, you find a small diamagnetic susceptibility, which is due to superconducting fluctuations. So when the pseudo gap drops, when the onset of the pseudo gap drops in the range where TC is, it becomes very difficult to know what happens. But I think the superconducting fluctuations, when you put disorder, you can suppress part of them, while the pseudo gap doesn't seem to be suppressed. So this is one of the arguments which pushes me to say that it's more straight.
What is it?
What?
Sorry, if it's not, you're telling us it's not superinducting fluctuations. Mm-hmm. What would you associate with
it? Well, at the beginning we were saying this is completely linked with the anti-ferromagnetic interactions with J, etc., etc. It could be RVB. It could be an RVB-like stuff. You don't have to call RVB a precursor pairing. So if you have a magnetic, any kind of magnetic coupling which reduces the susceptibility because you grow your Sangreis singlets, it would be that. I mean, so for me, it's the magnetic correlation which are driving the pseudo gap. Clearly, it's.
Robert, a related question. I mean, there's a preprint from, I don't know if it's from your group, it's from Ciclay, which claims that there's actually an onset of polarized neutrons, an onset of some kind of ring current.
Yeah.
For.
Now, I know, from Bursch.
You should see also in NMR, presumably, you're splitting some NMR.
No, this is really a question which Varma has asked us for 10 years. Well, we have been discussing.
Your opinion
on this. It's impossible to see. It's the NMR is very insensitive to this term, right, because the nuclei are not located at the right place.
None of the nuclei.
It's.
Follow-up question, because this result, I think, came up last week several times. So, since you probably know about it, can you, in 2 minutes, say the summary of that, or?
The summary is that there's some kind of additional order within the unit cell, magnetic order.
Orbital. It's a Varma order.
All right.
It's commensurate. It's a ferromagnetic.
It's commensurate. It's, well, it basically is simply some additional magnetic order, which is of the
orbital,
with zero net external moment, but which nonetheless exists within the unit cell. So it basically breaks essentially the point group symmetry of the unit cell. So it shows up as a polarized. Additional polarized beam scattering that you see on cooling on the main bright piece. So it's commensurate in point size with the underlying reciprocal lattice vectors of the nuclear lattice. So that's the point number one. And then it basically sets in at the same. The thing is that one thing that people quite often forget is that the pseudo gap transition, there were old results from ETH many years ago. There's actually changes in the crystal structure of the material. Again, internal rearrangements of units, so the oxygens move a little bit to the second part of Pinsky's. And so there's basically a set of things that happen to the crystal, which are of the proper phase transition. And until now, the knowledge has been that there have been structural changes there, but there's now also a magnetic change. They've seen that the systematics of the onset of that magnetic change coincides with some measure of the pseudo gap.
What material was it?
This is YBCO.
YBCO.
They have 3 or 4 samples that they've looked at. And I have to say that, I don't see anything at all wrong with we're talking. I mean, this looks pretty solid. There's one small problem, which is that it is on a, there's a very large background. Even what you do is you do a spin flip measurement. But that scattering, of course, there's always a leakage turn through from the non-spin flip channel. So there's a, it sits in a background. But then, so then what you rely on is that, that the spin flip channel has a temperature dependence, whereas the non-spin flip channel does not. And so it's reasonably, I have to say, I don't see how you can pull yourself.
Okay, so with that, I think we should bring this session to a conclusion.
Okay.